Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. We are joined by one of the great heroes of that war, as far as I'm concerned. His name is Dr. Peter Pry. He's been a guest with us from time to time in the past, usually to talk about a particularly momentous challenge that this country is facing, namely the vulnerability of really the backbone of our society, the electric grid, to attack, either by man-caused forces or perhaps through naturally occurring effects. And Peter has been just one of the great thinkers and leaders on the effort to protect the grid, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us. Peter, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Listen, you bring so many different skill sets to bear, your time in the intelligence community, your service as the executive director of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse or EMP Attack, and much more. We had a chance to visit a little bit this morning at a meeting, and you spoke about something that I really wanted to bring urgently to the attention of our audience, namely the news stories about this North Korean freighter that was stopped and searched in Panama, at the request, I guess, of the U.S. government. Tell us what we know about that freighter, what it was up to, what it had in its hold.
Well, we know the freighter had stopped in Cuba and picked up SD-2, that is surface-to-air ballistic missiles that are of Russian design from the Cold War period, and they hid them under bags of sugar and were trying to sneak them back through the Panama Canal to bring them back to North Korea. And it's kind of a mystery as to why they were doing that, because North Korea is actually the arsenal of autocracy, and its technology is far more sophisticated than Cuba. So we're not sure why they were carrying these SA-2s. But from an EMP perspective, one of the nightmare scenarios that the Commission worried about was the possibility of a rogue state like Iran or North Korea carrying a ballistic missile in its hold in the Caribbean, off the coast of the United States, where we basically had no missile defenses and no radars to warn us, and launching a nuclear warhead on that missile to take down the U.S. electric grid. And here we have a case where, indeed, you know, North Korea had missiles in its hold. And the SA-2, even though it's a surface-to-air missile, it's a very powerful one with a long range. This is the missile that was used to shoot down Gary Francis Powers in 1962 when he was flying the U-2. So it has a very high altitude reach. And it could do an EMP attack on the United States. And that's why they were doing it. That's clearly not what they were up to. But it is very interesting that we didn't even know until those sugar bags were removed that numerous of these SA-2 missiles were in the hold of a North Korean freighter. And North Korea is no stranger to those waters, nor are Iranian freighters. I think most Americans will come as a surprise that these bad guy rogue states are doing things we don't even know what they're up to, just south of our border.
Peter, there's so much to talk about there, but let's just stick with the missiles themselves for a moment. Am I right to understand what you've said, that if configured with an atomic device of some kind, perhaps one optimized for EMP effects, and you've warned that that may be precisely what the North Koreans are up to, that this vehicle, this launch vehicle, could be used to mount such an attack, and perhaps from just such a tramp steamer as it was on under North Korean flag?
Exactly. Well, one of the other things the Commission concluded is that North Korea probably has, I would say the Commission, if it were still in existence today, would say almost certainly has what is called a super EMP warhead. This is a nuclear weapon of advanced design, originally conceived by the Russians, and the technology was leaked to North Korea. This can generate an extraordinarily powerful EMP field, you know, that would take out even hardened electronics, in the United States. And the characteristic, one of the most worrisome characteristics about this warhead design is that it's extremely small and light. It basically resembles a neutron bomb in its design. And the United States, for example, during the Cold War, you know, the W84 warhead weighed less than 50 kilograms. It could be delivered by artillery tubes. And so something like that could fit on an SA-2 missile and could be delivered over the United States.
All right, so let's go back to the vulnerabilities that we have in a couple of different regards, Peter. One is the vulnerability of the grid itself. And again, our guest is Peter Pry. Dr. Peter Pry was the executive director of the EMP Commission convened by the Congress to evaluate this threat. He is serving currently as the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. You've also been a professional staff member in the Armed Services Committee in the House and an intelligence officer and many other credentials, including not least your authorship of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an EMP Catastrophe. So tell us a little bit more about the vulnerability of our electric grid to this sort of attack, Peter, and also just a little bit more about how it could be that we do not have radars or missile defenses looking southward, which, given what's in the Caribbean, notably the Cubans and beyond that the Venezuelans and perhaps others, would seem to be a threat axis we should not ignore.
Indeed. Well, the way an EMP takes down the electric grid is, imagine a super energetic radio wave, or it's like super lightning, far more powerful and faster than lightning, and gets past surge arresters that are designed for lightning, both because of its power and its speed. The EMP travels at the speed of light, and it can deliver, in the case of a super EMP weapon, 200,000 volts per meter, you know, against targets. And, you know, that will fry out microelectronics, practically any kinds of electronics. The thing that is we're most concerned about is the big transformers called extra high voltage transformers. These aren't our civilization with the aqueducts were to the Roman Empire. Modern electronic society can't exist without these transformers, which makes the electric grid work. They take years to build. They're extremely expensive, and we don't even manufacture them in this country anymore. You know, there are about 3,000 of them in our grid. And the estimate is that if these were taken out by a nuclear attack or by a natural EMP, the sun can do this too by means of a great solar superflare that can generate a natural EMP effect, very similar to a nuclear EMP in many respects, and it would burn out the transformers. And that would basically be it. If you lose the transformers, the electric grid collapses, not just temporarily, but for months or most likely years. And when the electric grid doesn't work, all the other critical infrastructures, within about 72 hours, also collapse. You'll lose communications, transportation, banking and finance, and even food and water depend ultimately upon electricity to preserve the food, to preserve the water. People should be aware that this isn't just a protracted blackout that is convenient. It's fatal.
Yeah, we will lose millions of people if that comes to pass. Just very quickly, we have a vulnerability in part because we have no means of defending ourselves against these missiles coming from the south. It's not all that it should be from other littoral waters as well. Peter Pry, we're both at a very important speech by Congressman Trent Franks this morning up on Capitol Hill, at which he addressed a group about this very problem, the EMP threat, the need to defend against it, and some steps that we should be taking on the missile defense side as well. Tell us very quickly, Peter, about the SHIELD Act that Congressman Franks has introduced and is seeking to get enacted in the hopes of actually doing something about this, the vulnerability of our grid that you've just described.
Right. There's bipartisan support for the SHIELD Act. Democrats and Republicans alike have supported this measure in the past. And basically, there's no excuse for the country to be vulnerable to this existential threat. We do know how to protect the transformers. The technology has existed for 50 years, but it's been used in the Department of Defense to protect military systems. We can very affordably, very inexpensively, and a robust protection of the national electric grid could be achieved for $2 billion tops. That's the big estimate. We give that to foreign aid in Pakistan every year. It seems that it would be worth spending that to save millions of American lives. The SHIELD Act would empower the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission with the authorities it needs to require the electric power industry, you know, to protect transformers and other critical components of the grid so that we would we would be able to survive and recover from a natural and nuclear EMP catastrophe.
An absolutely critical imperative. Peter Pry, we appreciate your leadership on it enormously. I hope that you will come back to us with periodic updates as to how we're coming with respect to the SHIELD Act. That's H.R. 2417, folks. Please get your members of Congress to support it. Your life, quite literally, may be on the line. Next up, Jim Henson gives us a boots-on-the-ground perspective on Gitmo, sexual assaults in the military, and the hollowing out of our armed forces, and what it means for you. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
A reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change your minds.
They're not going to change your minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we are by Jim Henson from time to time. He is the boots on the ground guy here at Secure Freedom Radio, a former weapons sergeant for the 1st Army Special Operations Command. He was in the Pacific Rim, among other places, in his time in uniform. He is now the director of business development for Absio and a guy who contributes frequently to the public policy debate at black5.net. And here, of course, Jim, welcome back. It's always good to have you.
Oh, pleasure, Frank.
Let's start, Jim, if we could, please. We've got this
weird thing happening. The president wants to let go the guys who are, or at least close down the guys who are now held up at Guantanamo. They're force-feeding those that are on hunger fasts. And they just had to kill one of them that they let go earlier, who is now back running al-Qaeda in Yemen. What do we make of this from a strategic as well as a common-sense point of view?
Yeah, Frank, it's a pretty bizarre situation. It almost, you know, on some level seems like we're running a terrorist game farm, you know, where we fatten them in Gitmo in order to someday release them and then knock them out with a drone. Yeah, I don't know. That's
a great
a science
analogy.
Fiction movie about this somewhere. It's horrifying. I mean, and a lot of, and to be fair, you know, it hasn't been Obama who let all these guys go. President Bush let plenty of these guys go back home. And the recidivism rate is ridiculous. You know, I think we still have no answer for what we're going to do with the absolutely recalcitrant Islamist terrorists that we capture. And I don't know that, you know, releasing them and then blowing them up is a great idea, unless we're maybe putting trackers on them and leaving the, you know, they're leading us to their friends. That would be a good use of it in my mind. I don't think we're doing that. So it's a bizarre situation where now we're making human rights violations. Yeah.
I just want to say I think that analogy is really very much on point. It's a little twisted, of course, but we expect nothing less from you. Again, we're talking with Jim Henson. He is our duty expert on what the troops are thinking about what's going on in this world of ours. But Gitmo, as we just discussed, Jim, how about sexual assault? We're told it's a rising problem. The solution to which the Congress would have us believe is to take the uniform command chain of command out of the mix, leaving it to, I guess, civilian prosecutors to decide what to do with these folks. We also have some concerns about what President Obama has been saying about all this as it relates to what's called undue command influence. Make sense of this for us, if you would.
Well, Frank, there is a legitimate problem in the military with sexual assault. That is undisputed. I am hesitant to look to Congress to solve much in the way of any kind of problem. So I can't really favor the, you know, the Gillibrand idea of creating a separate justice system. But the military has done a horrible job of commanders not using their influence to protect their own and to stop their units from looking bad. And consequently, we've had a number of people, far too many, who have failed to be punished for some pretty horrific crimes. And I think that's a problem that needs to be dealt with. I don't want Congress dealing with it. I want the military to deal with it. And, you know, that's something that I think, regardless of the solution, President Obama made it more difficult by doing just exactly what you said. His comments around when people commit these crimes, they need to be dishonorably discharged, court-martialed, beaten with sticks, and run out of town on a rail. Yeah, and the guy's supposed to be a constitutional law professor of some sort. You would think that he had the common sense to know that when you are an influencer, and in this case, the top influencer, you can't tell everyone under you what to do prior to a trial or a court-martial. And now there are defense lawyers all over the place, you know, trying to get their clients off of charges or trying to get punishments taken off the table because of these idiotic statements the commander-in-chief made.
Yeah, it's a really worrying problem.
He didn't help the situation.
Yeah, no question about it. And I'm not sure that other practices and policies that he's engaged in, which you and I have discussed in the past, like having more sort of sexual sort of opportunities, shall we say, in the mix, whether it's of the female male type or whether it's the homosexual type. It's really a nightmare, and I'm just fearful that it's a profound distraction from what the military should be focusing on and needs to be able to do. Which brings me to my last question for you, Jim, and that is I'm keenly interested in what the guys and gals, for that matter, that you're in touch with in uniform are making of what's happening to the hollowing out of the military. Again, another policy of the Obama administration to some extent, some blame to Congress as well. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has recently said in a letter to the Senate Armed Services Committee that, you know, if you guys don't fix this, we're going to have to find $52 billion more out of the defense budget, which is going to have all kinds of implications for not just civilians, but also military personnel for readiness, training, and almost certainly on morale. The vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has actually said that, you know, we're not going to be able to respond to crises that are going to come as a result of, you know, the cumulative effect of all this. How are the troops taking it, Jim? And do they, are they likely to vote with their feet in an all-volunteer force?
No doubt. I mean, morale right now is significantly affected by the fact that after more than a decade of constant deployment, war, their friends being killed, being wounded, you know, all of the difficulties on the home front, they don't feel like now there is any support for the military in the very institutions that provide that support, in Congress, in the executive branch. They feel like they're on call, but not being given the tools and the support they need to be able to recall, to respond in a way, you know, that's going to not just put them out their cannon fodder. It's hurting the troops. It is hurting retention. And the bottom line is, if things don't at least show some concern, you know, some idea that they're doing things that are going to make it better, we're going to have not just a hollow force, but a non-existent strategic capability. And that's affects us in so many ways. I don't even know how to start talking about them.
Well, again, I what I value so much about our conversations, Jim, is that you're bringing the perspective of somebody who's actually, you know, had to do the heavy lifting, be the pointy end of the spear in our military, in some of the most sensitive and often thankless or unacknowledged jobs in the military. That business about if we've broken it, there will be consequences. It just take us a little further down that road, not only in terms of what it takes to reconstitute the military once we've broken it, but also what it does in terms of emboldening enemies of this country.
Well, we're a deterrent force. The U.S. military is best served as a deterrent force. We don't want to use it. People should be scared to do bad things, because if they do, bad things will happen to them. If they don't believe that, they're going to do bad things and we're going to pay the price. That's where we're heading. And that includes the Chinese, that includes the Russians, and that includes any number of other groups that now do not feel that we are going to respond if they take actions that are detrimental to their people, our people, and the security of the planet as a whole. We are in a global 911. And if that number doesn't, if nobody answers when that number is dialed, that has bad consequences for everybody.
A lot of more emergencies. As Don Rumsfeld famously said, weakness is provocative. Jim Hansen, plain old-fashioned common sense. It's deeply appreciated that you provide it to us. Keep up the good work. Thank you for your past service to our country and, of course, what you're doing now at Absio. And come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Cord Sterling about how all this sequestration budget cutting is impacting the critically important defense industrial base and what that'll mean for you as well. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee conducted a job interview of sorts yesterday, but no prudent businessman would allow a prospective employee to get away with the performance Samantha Power turned in, let alone hire her for a job as significant as America's next representative to the United Nations. Senator Marco Rubio did what passed for the only serious grilling of this longtime anti-American leftist. He asked repeatedly what Power meant in 2003 when she denounced, quote, crimes committed, sponsored, or permitted by the United States, unquote. The job applicant kept bobbing and weaving twice by insisting that she loves this country. If senators allow Samantha Power to get by with such transparent dissembling, they will share responsibility for the poor job performance she is certain to turn in for the American people. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined by Cord Sterling. He is a vice president of the Aerospace Industries Association, a role that he is performing, having served in a number of different capacities in the United States government, as a Marine, for one, as a member of the Senate staff, working for Virginia Senator John Warner from 2003 to 2006, and also as a member of the professional staff for the Senate Armed Services Committee. A man of many parts, but the part that we're most interested in at the moment is the analysis that he and his colleagues have been doing of the impact of the sequestration cuts that we were discussing earlier with our friend Jim Hansen as they relate to the military. To discuss now what is happening to the industrial base that is absolutely critical to the support and the warfighting capabilities of that military. Cord Sterling, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's our pleasure, especially since some of the things that we forecast when you last visited, I think, in terms of dire consequences to the industrial base and specifically layoffs and loss of capacity seem not to have happened. Is that because they won't? That we were wrong, that we were crying wolf, perhaps, or is it because they simply haven't materialized just yet?
Well, I think it's twofold. First of all, you've got to look at what the industry has done. This was not something that just happened overnight. There was a lot of information and evidence leading up to it when they passed the Budget Control Act. And as you know, company leaders and businessmen, they have to structure based on what is known. And the law of the land, the Budget Control Act, with the various budget caps being lowered, was what they knew. So there was a lot of restructuring leading into this period of time. And you will see that the companies, a lot of them, not only reorganized, and if you go look at the various press releases and other directories that are out there, you'll see that, but they also downsized the number of offices, positions, and parts of the company.
So they started taking those steps, even though the Obama administration was saying not to worry, this isn't going to happen, don't plan for this, don't tell your folks that you're laying them off.
It's hard to explain to the shareholders to which you owe fiduciary responsibility that you waited, even though that's the law of the land. So they take actions and they position their companies for to be able to weather the storm to the extent that that is possible. But you've also got to remember the other side of it, and that is if you look at any analysis we did, it shows that it really takes place over about a 12 to 18 month period in which sequestration comes in, and it's largely because of the way it's implemented, which is it cuts funds that have not been obligated as yet on program. So all the funding that has been there, and when you're dealing with procurement and R&D accounts, which are largely the account from which the Pentagon customers are buying goods and services from the industry.
Kind of discretionary accounts.
They're discretionary until they're under contract and they're obligated.
Right.
But they are discretionary and they're multi-year. In other words, a lot of these funds were from prior year. They got obligated and now you see programs and work being done that applies to last year's numbers, not this year's numbers, not next year's numbers. However, as those contracts become, you know, as they mature and they end, and then you will do a new contract or new task orders on those contracts with new funding that has not yet been obligated, that's the money that's being sequestered. That's the money that's being reduced. And so that's when you will see that start to flow into the contracting community a little bit more.
So in other words, Court Sterling, there's a lag time that's been built into this, and the real effects of even that first year, 2013 round of budget cuts, has not manifested itself fully, in addition to the point you've made that some of these companies have tightened belt already.
Yeah. One important note is, A, the restructuring that's taken place among some of the large companies, but the supplier base. Remember, the supplier base are providing long lead time items in many cases. They're providing parts, pieces that will go into a system that will be delivered a year or 2 years from now. They're already feeling the pain. We've gone out to our members and we've talked to them and to what extent it is already impacting their business. And it appears pretty broadly that they are already starting to feel that as orders are being reduced because they know that ultimately the end product for which their component, their part, their assembly is going to be incorporated is going to be reduced. So we do start to see that amongst the supply chain, and that's some of the most critical parts of the industrial base, that supply chain.
And I want to come to that. We're going to talk about 2014 in a minute because that's a whole other story. But just staying with what's happening now, Court Sterling, I think in our previous conversations, again, from your vantage point as a vice president of the Aerospace Industries Association, talk a little bit about what the condition of that supply base is. In some cases, as I understand it, we're down to a single supplier of critical pieces that are necessary to ships or planes or missiles or fighting vehicles of one kind or another. What happens if those guys simply don't have the capacity to weather these cuts. Are we going to lose them? And if so, are we going to find ourselves relying on very unreliable foreign sources of supply for the such kits?
That is the challenge and the risk. As you said, a lot of that supply chain, remember, we are a high-tech industry. When you're looking at the components, you're looking at what goes into a system. That is very high-tech. Radar systems, communications and systems, sensors, things of that nature. These are very high-tech. And in many cases, their systems on the defense side are only being sold into the Department of Defense, maybe some to our allied countries, Great Britain, Australia, etc. But they are key components that are going into those systems are high-tech. These are the ability to manufacture that are industrial base. People forget is our people. It is the skilled engineers, scientists, and technicians. When those skills atrophy, when that company, that supplier, leaves the business and stops making that because there's no sales, there's no ability to deliver anything to a customer, you lose or you have a risk of losing that capability. And that is one of the greatest risks out there.
Now, and how clearly is it the case that those guys are not necessarily going to come back if you decide down the road that you've made a mistake and you do need more of their widgets?
Well, you never know until that time comes. But that's the big risk, because even if they are able to come back, you've now created an environment that is a very expensive capability to reconstitute. Once you lose those skills, whether it's the plant and equipment, which again can be replaced relatively easy, it doesn't mean it's easy, but it's relatively easy, but you lose the people, that's where it becomes the most critical. And, you know, I've always often used the analogy, you want to sail around in a ship that's nuclear powered and was put together by somebody who just graduated from nuclear welding school, or do you want somebody who's been doing that for 10, 20 years and has those skills? The same thing when it comes to aircraft and other activities. You want somebody who has the experience and has been doing that for a number of years. That's something you need to retain. You cannot recover.
And Court Sterling, it goes without saying, I think, that you want that person to be on our side. You don't necessarily want those guys to be Chinese, for example, manufacturing critical parts.
You can't rely upon a lot of that, you know, if you lose it and it's not amongst you and your allies, you have to run the risk of, can you rely upon it? Now, in some cases you can, because if it's Great Britain or Australia or Canada, obviously there's a greater ability to rely upon that. But let's be honest, a lot of them are relying upon our abilities, our skills, our capabilities.
And have been, yeah. Very quickly, Cord, we got less than a minute. 2014, any relief in sight?
It's hard to predict. I know that there are, you know, whenever you talk to people up on the Hill, you definitely, or in the administration, everybody wants to get rid of sequestration, but they can't come to an agreement on how to do that. I do believe that there's some good faith effort going on, but this is a very, very, very difficult one, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to do it before the end of the fiscal year, which is only a couple of months away. So I think we're going to be weathering through this for some time.
And the question is, can the industrial base on which our military critically depends actually weather this or not? And we will be following it closely, as I know will those of you at the Aerospace Industries Association. Cord Sterling, thank you for the terrific work you do there and for your prior service to our country and the Senate and the Marines. Keep it up. Come back to us if you would. This is vital importance to all of us, and we've got to stay abreast of it. Next up, we'll be talking with Fred Flights about, among other things, what's been going on in Iran. Is there any relief in sight from its nuclear ambitions straight ahead?
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaevs' kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Fred Flights, as we have the privilege of being each week. Fred is a senior analyst for Lignet.com. That's the Langley Intelligence Group Network's terrific online resource. Fred is a career intelligence official. He has served in a number of different capacities, both in the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of State, and on Capitol Hill, working for the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Fred, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Peter, Frank.
Fred, we see on your page today a story about how there's change at the top of the Iranian regime. The putative moderate who has been elected, Hassan Rouhani. But there doesn't seem to be much evidence that there's going to be any deviation from Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon. Tell us what you make of that. You've followed this regime and its antics very closely for a very long time. How do you see it, and what are the implications if this is in fact just basically a kind of bait and switch?
Well, Frank, it's good to be here. We try to make it clear that President-elect Rouhani is a so-called moderate. He was handpicked by the Iranian supreme leader, and he's not going to deviate too far from the extremist view of who's really running Iran, Supreme Leader Khamenei. But it's worth noting that Rouhani was the nuclear negotiator for Iran in the 2000s, and he basically cleaned the clocks of the EU and the United States by repeatedly pretending to agree to negotiations and slowing Iran's uranium centrifuge program while it escalated. And he's made it clear that the program isn't going to slow under his rule. He recently said he's interested in a new round of negotiations, and I think this is simply more posturing by this man. He's a brilliant diplomat, and he knows how to play the United States and Europe.
Yeah, and we seem to be falling for it all over again. The administration has indicated, as I understand it, that they are willing to enter into direct bilateral negotiations with the Iranians. This isn't, of course, the first time that's happened, but it does deviate some from the past practice of having to deal with multilateral negotiations, the so-called PERM 5 plus 1, involving the Russians, the Chinese, the Germans, the British and French. What is your current expectation, Fred, of these negotiations? Is it possible that they could produce anything other than more legitimacy for the regime on the one hand and more time for it to complete its nuclear weapons capabilities?
Well, let's first point out that the Obama administration has long wanted bilateral talks with Iran. They talked about this while Obama was a candidate. Iran has never agreed to this, but has agreed to multilateral talks. The United States has sent representatives to these talks. And each time we made more concessions, and the Iranians made more and more outrageous proposals. I think this is going to happen again. Since we keep moving the goalposts against our interests during these talks, the Iranians have every interest to continue to engage in them. And it's sort of incredible that the Obama administration is making such noises about diplomatic talks without laying down what the conditions will be. Iran has to agree to stop enriching uranium in defiance of U.S. Security Council resolutions and the IAEA. We're not hearing any of that from the White House.
Yeah. In fact, Fred Flights, it's my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that basically each time we sort of slacken, shall we say, the various requirements that we've either imposed unilaterally or that have been imposed through the international organizations of one kind or another, the Iranians have simply pocketed those concessions and again, seemingly even contemptuously, redoubled their efforts. Fred, give us a sense, again, as a longtime career observer and analyst of these matters in the intelligence business, of how far away the Iranians might be now from actually having these decades-long efforts come together in the form of deliverable nuclear weapons?
Well, there's a lot of confusion on this, Frank, and part of it is because Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu last fall signed on to the bogus red line theory of the Obama administration that Iran wouldn't have enough enriched uranium to make a dash for a weapon until the spring or summer of 2013. That's not true. Iran now has about enough uranium enriched to the 20% level to make one weapon, so that's the red line. However, in about 8 days, they could have enough nuclear fuel for one weapon using medium-enriched uranium. However, they have much more retrograde uranium, and they've had enough for a weapon since 2009. And in the view of Lignet, it would take an additional 37 days to make a weapon, and they have enough uranium to make 7 to 8 nuclear weapons right now. Just take 37 days longer to make enough for the first weapon.
So we're talking, Fred Flights, about a month's time in terms of lead time from any decision to proceed. And do we have reason to be confident that they haven't already made that decision to finish the job?
We don't. Iran could have secret centrifuge facilities. And we found that in North Korea a couple of years ago, when a facility that the U.S. Intelligence Committee denied existed for years was simply unveiled to a group of academics. The U.S. and other countries had no idea it existed. Iran could have one of these too.
Well, in fact, Reza Khalili, of course, a former agent in place inside the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, has repeatedly pointed out that there's evidence of secret facilities, some of which have now been taken offline, it appears, but others that are almost certainly continuing. Fred, let me switch gears in the remaining time we have with you to a related topic, namely the Islamists elsewhere in the Middle East, and what particularly has been happening of late to the Arab Spring, both, if you can, quickly, sort of the current state of play in Egypt and Syria.
Well, Syrian President Assad is delighted with what's going on in Egypt. He's claiming that proves what he'd been contending all along, that the Arab Spring protests were being driven by radical Islamist terrorists, including Al-Qaeda. And he's using it to justify to his supporters and people on the fence that he's justified in using a military crackdown to prevent radicals and terrorists from taking over his country. And I think it's going to put a chill over some of these liberation efforts. It's also going to encourage autocrats and Islamist leaders not to tangle with democracy in the future in the Arab world.
And you've seen a split that has now manifested itself most vividly in both Syria and in Egypt, a split between those in the Arab world like Qatar and Turkey, who seem perfectly prepared to sponsor, support, underwrite, arm, and otherwise help the Muslim Brotherhood. And on the other hand, you've got the Saudis, the UAE, the Kuwaitis, who are seemingly now putting their money in, you know, the opposition to the Brotherhood and its ilk, to say nothing of Al-Qaeda, notably the military in Egypt. Is that split likely to persist, and how do you think it plays itself out, Fred Flights?
I think it's going to persist. I think what happened in Egypt is a big loss to Turkey and Qatar. Now, Saudi Arabia backed the Morsi government, and now they're backing the post-Morsi government. This is a pragmatic move by the Saudis. The Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and the UAE saw what was going on in Egypt under the Muslim Brotherhood as extremely threatening to them because they didn't trust Muslim Brotherhood and what it might eventually have done to their governments.
Almost certainly. It may yet do. And for that matter, to the Qataris as well. We'll see. Anyway, Fred Flights, we have to let it go at that. Thank you so much for joining us and for the terrific work you do at Lignet.com. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week and to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow.
Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.